part of me would just like to say, hey, Caroline's back and has some stuff for us, but I need to do it a little bit more formally than that, because some of you don't know her, and I'd say it, I've known you since you were, I mean, that's because I'm young and she grew fast. Caroline is from Jackson, has been known by a lot of us in various contexts as she grew up and then came in and went through the program. And for me, it's fun to have people who've walked through coming back as knowledgeable people to offer back to the program. Caroline's work has been in eating disorders in her dissertation at Rosemead, and looking there, and she'll probably wanted to tell you these things, but I'm going to do this, and it takes away from her opportunity. Looked at paternal roles in disorders. If you think about eating disorders, all the work that's been done on mothers, and if you think in terms of family systems, we have two parents. And so the question comes, well, how does dad fit in, which is what she began to look at and research. For a doctoral internship, she worked in Colorado, works now in eating disorder care, not in the treatment per se at this point, but administering homes for the people who are there for the treatment. And then you want to think about that one a minute. So here are people with eating disorders who are away from home for a bit for residential care. And history-wise, their struggle has been especially related to intimate relations, parental relations. Okay, so now they're in a dorm. Now they're in housing type things. And I wonder what it looks like in those houses with house parents and other people who are siblings. So Caroline's work overseeing that kind of a thing, from my point of view, is a major treatment context where they're learning presumably new skills or to handle other hassles. Go back and think of your group therapy and the value of the group as a place to work your life structure out. So that's what Caroline's doing. We've got the opportunity to have her overview and present this to us. This is something that you'll certainly see in your practice. So you get to stand this morning on the shoulders of somebody who's got specialized training and years of it. From our point of view, Caroline's also a person who's married. This is a marriage and family therapy program, and that's happened since she was here, so I get to congratulate her on that. Her husband works making sure that sweatshops are not producing Cabela's goods. So if you buy things from Cabela's, he is why you're paying more. Now, that's my inference, and it may or may not be accurate, but if he's looking at human rights and they can't use sweatshops, it probably does affect the cost. At any rate, we are pleased to have you here.
Thank you.
You run the schedule. Tell them when they can come or not come or whatever.
Thank you. Thanks. All right. It is really fun to be back here. I know this room very well from Systematic Theology. Did y'all just finish Jan term, Systematic Theology? No? Oh. That's what was. Oh, sorry. That was like 10 years ago, so. But I remember that very well, Dr. Derek Thomas. So yeah, it's really fun to be back here. Even though I went on to do doctoral work after this, I really count RTS as my foundational training. This is where it began, and these are the roots that I go back to. And working with patients, and it all comes back to family systems. No matter how individualized the treatment is, it always comes back to family systems. So hold on to what you learn here. It's pretty incredible. I still have my printout of my 500th hour over at the clinic. I don't like to throw things away. Monumental moments. So you're getting there. Hold on. It's coming. This is a very brief overview of eating disorders. This is to give you a taste of what is out there. Hopefully it will give you just a leg up in terms of looking out for eating disorders, as well as treating them, assessing them, what forms of treatment to use, what modalities. So hopefully this will just give you a little foretaste, whet the appetite, so to speak. Thank you to Dr. Hurley for the intro. I work at a facility, used to be called Eating Disorder Center of Denver, and so you'll see that on some of the handouts. We're in the middle of a huge rebranding process, so half of our information says Eating Disorder Center of Denver, otherwise known as EDCD, and we just changed to ED Care. So same facility, just different names. I am one of the primary therapists slash staff psychologists there, and then also manage the Connections House where our patients stay. So kind of get the best of both worlds in terms of that. So let's get going. I will do kind of hour, kind of till 9:30. We'll take a break, come back till about 10:30, 10:40, take another break. I know your brains are tired. So we will take frequent breaks. Okay. Couple of cases. We will look at these at the beginning, and then we'll look at them at the end. Just want you to kind of look at them, pick out what you want, pick out what stands out, and kind of have these two cases in your mind as we go through the info. Sarah, non-identified individual, 18 years old, enters treatment 78 pounds at 5'1". So she, her BMI, that is body mass index. There's a lot of acronyms in the mental health field, so brace yourself. BMI, body mass index, 15 to 16. An average typical is anywhere from 19 to 21. So she's severely underweight. Roughly 68% of her ideal body weight. We shoot for 100%. 100, 105, 110. So she's severely underweight. Diagnosis of anorexia nervosa. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. Parents divorced at age 9. Very formative time of her development. Both parents remarried. She's only 18. She has a younger half-sibling, 6 years old. So a good 12 years younger. Her mother is her best friend. She is also the manager of a local smoothie shop. So she's around food all day long. She has had two previous episodes of care. She's only 18. Two previous episodes of care. I mean, she's been in treatment twice before at ages 12 and 16. So she knows treatment very well, which can be good and bad. She has a long-term, ongoing outpatient therapeutic relationship, 2 to 3 years. Same therapist. Okay. Mary Sue. I went for some Southern names, so it was kind of fun. Mary Sue. 19 years old, Caucasian female. BN is bulimia nervosa, so I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. She's 105% ideal body weight, so much more average. That's good. 158 pounds at 5'9". Again, good weight range. Her BMI is 21 to 22. So kind of think what you may about those facts in terms of average, not average. She's the oldest child, has one younger sister. She withdrew from her first year of college. Temperamentally, she's very impulsive and avoidant. Her mother significantly has significant disordered eating, although claims she does not have an eating disorder. Very highly anxious and controlling mother. Very, very powerful individual within the family, so kind of runs the ship. Father travels frequently and is incredibly passive, so think about the dynamic set up there. Combine that with an impulsive, avoidant daughter, you've got an interesting setup. She independently admitted to treatment, so she came on her own at age 19, which is huge. Typically, it's parents that get them in the door, or school, or school or work or something like that. They kind of have an ultimatum, but she did this on her own. Significant substance use really emerged during her first year of college. So this, she's new to the field, so to speak, in that. And this is her first episode of care. All right, so two cases, kind of think about them a little bit different, but yet a lot of similarities. So we'll review those towards the end. Okay. So really just kind of 101 basic eating disorders. I want to lay this out there so you can have an idea of what you will commonly see with individuals that have eating disorders. So a few statistics. They are very common, likely more common than you realize. And this, we'll see later, that it can be on a continuum in terms of symptoms that you might see. So of patients just coming to the attention of mental health professionals, so this does not include those that don't even report it, or those that don't show up in treatment, or even just an outpatient therapist office. 90% are female, 10% are male. Why do you think that is? Yep. So much of the 10% is that it's underreported. And I guarantee you it's out there. But in the media, it's such a woman's disease. It's a female disease. It is gender specific, and the truth is it's not. Eating disorders know no discrimination. They reach any and all kind. 5 to 10 million women and girls are affected by this. 2 million men and boys, again, of what's reported. 90% of young women who develop an eating disorder do so between 12 and 25. We treat in our facility, we're age 18 to 65. And yes, there are 65-year-old women that come in for the first time ever. But age 18 to 65 is what we treat, but we know that it starts much younger, that the seeds are planted early. Many times we see this kind of midlife resurgence of 40 to 50-year-olds seeing this just resurgence, this reappearance of roots that began in early adolescence, late adolescence. Of bulimia nervosa, kind of bulimia and anorexia are kind of the two main branches or two main types of eating disorders. And 2 to 5% of females are between ages 13 and 35. And then 0.5 to 1% of females between 13 and 35. So just to kind of give you that really is kind of the main time frame between 13 and 35. Right now at ED Care, our milieu, I would say 90% is between 17 and 25. So it's just very, very young. We've got a young milieu, but we've also kind of seen that we've kind of had an older milieu at times. Milieu is just milieu therapy, it's the environment of the patients, so to speak. So they are very, very complex. It's not straightforward. I think this is one of the reasons that I really love treating them is because there's nothing that's by the book with them. And so you're always surprised, and I love being on my toes. So it's pretty cool to see even my supervisor. She's been in the field, specifically eating disorders, for over 40 years. And just last week I heard her say, well, that's new. So it's exciting in that sense. Feels kind of weird to say that, but it's true. So they're very, very complex. There's a biological, genetic, temperamental aspect to the eating disorders. We'll go over the different... Is this echoing as much for y'all as it is for me? I'm looking at Mike. So there's a temperamental aspect to it, and we'll go over a little bit of that within bulimia. There's certain temperament within anorexia, certain temperament you'll see more commonly.
Step back just a little bit.
Let's step back.
See if that helps.
Okay. Okay. Life events, trauma, divorces, birth of younger siblings when there's kind of a major age difference. Any kind of sort of psychological, psychosocial life event is going to really play a part in this. Media is huge. It is just huge. Our patients are constantly bombarded by media in terms of what is out there. I'll show you a few things about that. And then there's such a strong spiritual disconnection piece of it that it's painful to see. It really is. And I think that's really what drives my work. Even though I don't work in a nominally Christian facility, spirituality, religion is something that our patients really find to be important in their recovery. So we'll talk a bit more about that. I think that's a little bit better now that I'm back here. Okay. Okay, a few more quick stats. 25% of American men and 45% of women are on a diet any given day. It's kind of hard not to be with the media. I think I have an extra sensitivity to diet talk, if you will, because just of the world that I'm in 24/7. So what is likely, I have to kind of check myself every once in a while, what is likely very normal, I'm like, now what are you doing and why are you doing that? And what's your, my sisters are typically like, chill out. Americans spend over $40 billion on diet and weight loss products per year. $40 billion. 95% of all dieters will regain the lost weight in 1 to 5 years. Okay. We especially see this in our binge eating disorder patients. Diets do not work for them. You will see later because it's not about the food. It has nothing to do with the food. Dieting is a gateway behavior to eating disorders. Does this mean that all dieters will have an eating disorder? No. Yes?
Could you give us a definition of what you mean by diet?
I think restricting, our motto is there's no such thing as a bad food. Okay? I do give that in the context of patients that have eating disorders. We say that. There is a subjective definition. Yes. Because you have to play into, is there a genetic component? Do you have a family member that has an eating disorder? Did your mother have an eating disorder? Did your father have an eating disorder? Because if that's so, you got to be careful around dieting. You got to be careful around restricting your food intake, using a smaller plate versus a normal dinner plate. Does that mean that you can't have preferences of what you do and don't eat? No. But you got to take into consideration the impact, the influence of the social media, genetics, trauma, anything like that. It's the big picture. It's not just about the food. It's not just about the diet. I think you just have to individuals that might be more susceptible to eating disorders just have to be more careful around the idea of weight loss and body image and what they do and don't take in. So it's more of what's the makeup behind it, the intentions behind it. But there's no like specific definition with it.
I didn't know if it was like calories or food types or kind of what you were thinking there or all of it. You know,
all of the above, kind of any different angle. Yeah. So whether it's this diet versus that diet, Whole30 is huge right now. I'm not trying to be up here and say don't do Whole30. I'm just saying that's one of the bigger ones right now. And if you're more susceptible to body image, if you have patients that are more susceptible, just asking like, hey, what's the thought behind that? What's the intention behind that? Because it can be a slippery slope. Forty-two percent of first through third grade girls want to be thinner. That's unbelievable. They're first through third grade. 17% of 8 to 12-year-old girls said they have induced vomiting, used laxative or diet pills. Adolescent treatment's a real thing. Children's Hospital in Denver is huge, treating 8-year-olds, 12-year-olds. Among a sample of 2,877 undergraduate students, 13.5% of women and 3.6% of men screened positively for at-risk eating disorder behaviors. It's huge among college campus. That's where I did my pre-doctoral training. And it's it's huge on college campus for sure. Absolutely. Okay. That is a repeat in some of the stats. I will jump to shame and secrecy of illness leads to denial, underreporting, misdiagnosis, and inadequate treatment. There's a lot of shame, you know, just within the mental health field. And then there's this seemingly more intense and more vulnerable presentation amongst eating disorder patients. And I've seen shame flipped on its head several times in the sense of, I'm not sick enough to be in treatment. She can do it better than I can. She is stronger than I am because she can restrict longer than I can. Gosh, what does that say about me? Or, you know, I just must not be enough. I've seen shame turned on its head in that sense. Not even shame about how did I get here and guilt. It's really kind of turned towards reinforcing the eating disorder, unfortunately. As we saw with males, the underreporting is huge because of the shame and the need for secrecy. A lot of misdiagnosis, so hopefully this will help catch some things. And then, unfortunately, the inadequate treatment. Individuals that are in outpatient that maybe should be in PHP or IOP, intensive outpatient, because of the shame, because of the secrecy. So it's a ongoing cycle. One leads to the other. So here is kind of a continuum, just in terms of different types of eating disorders. At the bottom, you'll see kind of normal to natural eating. I did have a definition of dieting. I didn't know that I did. So there we go. You'll see kind of dieting and then kind of subclinical, so kind of pre-diagnosis, some description there, and then into full clinical eating disorder in terms of diagnostic, distinguishing the diagnosis. So normal, natural eating, you eat in response to hunger, you listen to satiety, you know, more accepting than body shape. I tell my patients, we all have some form of body image issue. We're fallen people. We see imperfections. We are imperfect. And so there's always some level of body image. A lot of patients set themselves up unknowingly of, I will accept my body all the time. No. And that's okay. You can live in that dissonance between the two. But more accepting than not of your size and shape. Dieting, calorie counting, cutting in terms of cutting quantities. Skipping meals or types of food. Good and bad foods, that's huge. Patients will come in saying safe and not safe foods. Those high in carbs and sugar and calories are typically the not safe. Those more natural are typically the good foods. And then following a diet regimen, whether by name, nominal name, or just kind of their own regimen, is typically how they would describe the dieting. Subclinical eating disorder, occasional binging or purging, diet pills, kind of that preoccupation with food and body, knowing what's in everything, and you know, subconsciously knowing how much you weigh, intuitively knowing how much you weigh and how much you've consumed and how much you've burned off. You can be subclinical and still know all that because there's that preoccupation. Some loss of control around food, kind of on the flip side. Kind of that inability to respond to hunger, that inability to respond to satiety. So some of that kind of loss of control around food. And then the actual diagnostic clinical eating disorder, and we'll talk about the different types. So this is a more well-known one, anorexia nervosa. Significantly low body weight, restricting energy and food intake. You need food for energy. Intense fear of gaining weight. Crawling out of your skin, fear of gaining weight. Very distorted body image. You'll see a slide in a second of Literally what they see is not what the rest of the world sees. And it actually happens in the brain. It's pretty incredible. Extreme focus on shape and weight, body size and weight. A lot of denial. A lot of denial. And the most common age of onset in teens. So there's two different types. You've got anorexia nervosa, so limiting the food intake, extreme fear of gaining weight. You've got the restricting type, so it's just straight up restricting. This is definitely the more classical, old school, as they call. Restricting types are just not eating, delaying, keeping yourself busy, not sitting down, just not eating. And then there's also the purging type. So if you do eat anything, you purge. And there's many different forms of purging. So this is an fMRI study that shows what happens in the brains of anorexics. And what this is pointing out is literally the visual cortex. Do I have a... Oh, this is awesome. Literally the visual cortex that is active in all these others. So anorexic women looking at other women, so they can see what is there in other women. They can see if someone is of normal body size, if someone is underweight. I mean, they'll tell me all day long about how sick their friends are in treatment, but they won't tell me that they're sick. Did you see what she did at lunch? I'm like, so they can see it in other people. Normal women looking at others, they can see sickness or not sickness. I mean, they can see it's active. Normal women looking at themselves, okay. They have an accurate representation. There is nothing going on in the anorexic brain. They can't see it, literally. It's unreal. And at times, I mean, after doing this for a number of years, I'm still like, how can you not see it? And I have to remember this. I don't say that because that's slightly invalidating. But it's true. It is a genetic mutation. They cannot see it.
Is there any neurofeedback process being used?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not going to get into it because that's a little outside of my field. but there is. It's actually kind of cutting edge, very important. Only a few facilities do it. We don't, but it's pretty huge. Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's amazing. One of my supervisor, Dr. Tamara Pryor, she's our clinical director, and she is doing a lot of work just in terms of anatomy, neuroanatomy, different areas of the brain, what's activated in anorexia nervosa, what's activated in bulimia. So there's just a ton of research right now. It's pretty cool. I wish I were more of a research guru, but I'm not. That's why I did my PsyD, because I knew I couldn't do research. So bulimia, recurrent binge eating. And binge eating is described by an objective large amount of food by social comparison. So I'm talking 2 to 3 pieces of pizza compared to a whole pizza. Okay? That binge eating would be a whole pizza. I'll do a pint of ice cream, give or take a little bit, to a half gallon. So a half gallon, and both of those, pizza and half gallon. Throw in 12 donuts or so. Notice when I'm naming these foods, they're typical binge foods, all high in sugar, all high in carbs. So there's a lot of even a meaning in terms of what people binge on. A lot of times it's sweet versus salty. So what's that about? Typically, there's an emotional need behind the food choice. Emotional. I mean, when you're feeling emotional, what do you go for? You go for the cookies. You go for the cereal. You go for the things that make you feel warm and fuzzy. It's the same thing. It's just on a really extreme basis. Okay. Sense of feeling out of control, most definitely. I've had patients say they're detached, totally disoriented when they're in the middle of a binge. No clue how they wound up in Krispy Kreme and bought 2 dozen donuts. It just happened. There's always a compensatory behavior in bulimia, okay? There's always a compensatory behavior. If there wasn't, it would be binge eating disorder, which we'll get to. So there's always a compensatory behavior, such as vomiting, laxative use, excessive exercise, talking like 3 hours at a time, and doing that several times a day. So, you know, think about preoccupation. It takes up your whole day. Something that we're seeing a good bit that gets a little bit confusing diagnostically is we're seeing people fasting, aka restricting, because of the binge. So it gets a little tricky. Look at your DSM-5. It'll help you. But it can get a little bit confusing because they go through this restriction phase, but it's the compensation for the binge phase. And so that's why it ends up at bulimia. Also extreme focus on body and weight. And then the frequency is occurring at least one time a week for about 3 months. We'll go over changes in the recent DSM-5. And that's one of the changes, is the frequency. Binge eating disorder. Recurrent binge eating episodes characterized by eating large amounts of food with a sense of loss of control. Okay. So again, very much like bulimia, but there's no compensation for it. The binges themselves are associated with eating much faster than normal, eating until uncomfortably full. Talk about not paying attention to hunger cues, which is one of our huge treatment goals for those with binge eating disorder, is just eating large amounts of food when not feeling hungry at all. Lot of eating alone within binge eating disorder. Hiding food. Had a patient that would keep all of her food in her drawers in her room. Just a lot of embarrassment, guilt, shame. So kind of that hoarding, hiding food piece. And then the frequency, 2 days per week for about 6 months. This is a very important section. I think sometimes we kind of see the unspecified or the other specified that's in the DSM. And for eating disorders, and I think this is so true for other psychiatric illnesses, these are no less important and no less severe. Actually, I would say purging disorder is much more medically scary than some of the others, if I could pit one against the other. And we'll go over some of the medical complications, but with a purging disorder, your potassium can plummet, and that will kill you, because your electrolytes get very off balance and your potassium plummets. We've had people come in, I think she was there about 3 weeks ago, came in potassium at 1.8, and it needs to be about 2.7. It doesn't sound like a lot. It took me a little while to really kind of get those numbers, but 1.8 is, it's the lowest we've seen. Our docs don't think I've ever seen him run through the hall, and he ran through the hall, and we whisked her away to the hospital. So, because she's a purger, she purges. So, purging is huge. So these other specified are kind of a different category, but bulimia nervosa, lower frequency or just limited duration. So, less times per week, lasting for a shorter amount of time, but again, it's deserving of a diagnosis. Kind of same thing with binge eating disorder. I spoke a bit about purging disorder. So there's not necessarily the restriction piece, but it's just constant purging, okay, in one form or the other. Atypical anorexia, we've seen a good bit of this. I think we've seen more of it because the DSM-5 has identified it. But all of the symptoms for anorexia, the restriction, the fear of gaining weight, significant body image, preoccupation, all of that is there, but their weight range is still normal. So it's still within that ideal weight range, anywhere from 90 to 100% of your ideal body weight. So if you're 5'5", an ideal body range would be, this is going to test me, like 115 to 130, 110 to 135, kind of people different degrees, but anywhere from kind of 90 to 100% of your ideal body weight. Because maybe they were so overweight or whatnot, they've gone into this restriction phase, but their weight is still within that normal range. Well, they're still displaying the symptoms of anorexia nervosa. So that's why we don't like to focus only on the weight in terms of the diagnosis. Does that make sense? Kind of that atypical presentation. Yes,
that's a huge component.
Huge component. Okay. Yeah, the patients don't like that, but it is a huge component. I'll use her as an example in many other incidences. But I had a patient just discharged after 5.5 months with us, and that's a long time in higher level of care. It's not so much in outpatient, but that's a long time in outpatient in higher level of care, because I saw her. Between groups and individual, I'd see her 5 times a week. And she was with us 5.5 months. She came in at 62% of her ideal body weight. So she was 5'9", came in at, oh no, she left it. She came in at 80-something pounds at 5'9", and she restored 40 pounds while she was with us. Unbelievable. Definitely a success story. So recovery is possible. So yes, weight restoration. Sometimes we have to say nutritional rehab because they know what restoration means. It's kind of one of those buzzwords for them. So we sometimes have to find a way around it. It's a big part. And then night eating syndrome. Recurrent night eating. Really kind of the key with this is it's not better explained by binge eating disorder. Frequent episodes of night eating that are not better explained by a medical condition, sleepwalking, something like that. But there is something called night eating syndrome.
How does body dysmorphic disorder fit into these disorders?
So it is under, in the DSM-5, I'm not sure what category I was going to say, potentially anxiety category or even phobia. I'm not sure DSM-5 actually where it fits in. But literally body dysmorphia is intense dissatisfaction with the body where it does fit in with this, but it can have more of a flavor of I'm backing up a little bit. All of our patients have some form of dysmorphia, but it's not diagnosable, so to speak, because these are primary. These trump the dysmorphia. Could somebody have body dysmorphic disorder and not have an eating disorder? Yeah. I think it'd probably be pretty rare. I haven't given a body dysmorphic disorder diagnosis in a while. Do I? Yeah. But really, it's just more about the dissatisfaction coupled with the eating habits. It's kind of a gray area. I totally get your question. For me, the eating disorder kind of trumps it. It's more global than body dysmorphia is. Feet, a certain area of body, men, muscle mass, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good question. It's actually one that I...
How's that work when you don't see your body?
That's probably why I don't diagnose it. I don't know. Because I think about it like that. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what you have to rule out. Is the dysmorphia more based on a denial? Are we looking at denial of body versus I
I see my body. I'm obsessed with one aspect of my body more so than just my whole self. It's a lot of ruling out. Like I said, I don't give that diagnosis very often. Doesn't mean it's not necessarily there, but it's just not primary for me, in my opinion. So it's an interesting question, though. Okay. I have to think about that. So like I was saying, these unspecified, I mean, other specified, we call it OSFED, O-S-F-E-D. Like I said, everything is kind of shortened. So we call these OSFED. These are no less serious. I know I mentioned that earlier, but just to keep that in mind. 50% of eating disorders are atypical, meaning they fail to meet DSM criteria for anorexia or bulimia. Okay, so 50% are going to fall in here. It's a lot. They're no less serious, present as just as difficult challenges for treatment. Absolutely. We honestly fight a lot with insurance. I shouldn't say fight. That's just more of my cynicism. We work collaboratively with insurance companies. And it's hard sometimes for me to if I'm not sure what's going on, I'll give the unspecified, and I am reluctant as I'll get out because I know how they see it. And I don't want to speak too ill of insurance companies because they allow our patients to come. But it is hard because they're not there. They can't see it. They don't know the individuals. I'm hesitant to slap a diagnosis on there when I don't feel comfortable. I just feel like it's unethical. And that's just my own personal opinion. And so I will do rule outs. I will do unspecified. I'll do EDNOS. And I kind of always am like, because I know that they may not see the severity of it. So that's why awareness and advocacy is so important, that these atypical presentations are not any less serious. So in terms of just kind of assessment, initial assessment of eating disorder, this is a huge, huge part. That intake process is huge in terms of all the different components, eating habits, family history. Something I always ask is, what does a typical day look like for you in terms of meals and snacks? Just, what'd you have for breakfast? What's typical? And I get the, well, not every day is the same. Give me an average. Well, there's not an average. What did you have today? And typically, the morning they come into treatment, it's like, oh, I had a full breakfast. I'm like, yeah, you did. So what did you have yesterday when you knew you were coming into treatment today? Because they want to look good when they come in today. What does a typical day look like for you? Current eating disorder symptoms. Do you keep down what you eat? Do you not eat what others eat? Do you have thoughts about what you eat in terms of content or calories? Do you count calories? If you track your calories on your phone, do you look at it obsessively? That sort of thing. Do you think about food and weight more than you think about other things during the day? How much of the day is preoccupied or occupied by thoughts about what you eat or don't eat? Biometrics are huge. So the beginning when I was doing ideal body weight and body mass index, all of that is huge. Insurance loves numbers. The confusing thing is that we try not to focus on numbers with the patients because they get tripped up, because their minds are like little squirrels, and they get tripped up on the numbers. And so while we're looking at the numbers in terms of what they're restoring or what, like their caloric intake, we don't necessarily use those numbers with them because it can, again, be turned on its head. But it's good to know age, height, current weight. Age is huge because you're going to be looking at metabolism. You're going to be looking at kind of what is a natural physical expectation according to their age. So someone that comes in at, you know, 52 years of age, which is that patient that I just had for 5.5 months. She was 52. Her metabolism is going to be so different than an 18-year-old who just has a coal engine for metabolism and is burning through 3,500 calories in half a day. I mean, it's just going to be very different. So that's important. Length of illness is huge. And this has to do with Guido Frank is a huge researcher we work with in Denver. And he speaks to the length of illness really affects the ability of the brain to change directions. Because neuropathways are created, habits are formed. If this has been around for 40 years, it's a tough road ahead. So length of illness really does matter. That's why, we'll go over this later too, treatment, early detection, early intervention, a lot of awareness. It's huge in terms of age. Medical complications are enormous. That's a whole other section. We'll go over that. Treatment history. This will speak to what they're familiar with. Resistance to treatment. Treatment fatigue. It's going to be huge if someone's come in and they've already been in treatment 4 to 5 times. You know that you've kind of got a different case on your hands. Just kind of idea of, have you been to treatment before? Family history, huge, the genetic component. Mothers, grandmothers, fathers, uncles, anything. And then obviously motivation, readiness for recovery is huge. So just kind of that general initial assessment. These are some of the big things to highlight. So what might you see? You know, what might you see when you've got a 14-year-old that comes in, their mom brings them into the clinic, and you sit down with them, and what might you want to look for? Okay, what could be some early signs? As well as asking dad, hey, what do you see your daughter or son do around dinner time? Do you notice any physical changes? Do you notice anything? Be the eyes and ears for me, kind of thing. So warning signs, excessive concern about weight and shape, talking about how they look, looking in the mirror a lot, body checking. Patients do that a lot where they're just constantly body checking, literally physically walking around holding themselves. Unexplained and or dramatic weight loss. Had a 17-year-old just recently. She actually discharged the day I left. Patients don't like transition very well, and I had 3 patients discharged within the first 48 hours I was gone of this trip. So my caseload subtracted by 75%. So they don't like transitions very well. Had a 17-year-old who lost, between June and October, lost 40 pounds. Just boom, 40 pounds. We think this actually might be a case that's headed to DHS, unfortunately. She also has diabetes, so there's kind of a lot of rule out between is this what we call diabulimia, where they intentionally manipulate their insulin injections in order to lose weight. But she had dramatic weight loss, so this would have been important for mom to let us know, hey, she's had dramatic weight loss, what are her considerations? But because we think the mother may be involved somehow, and mom was not a good historian in terms of that. Failure to gain weight in proportion to height. This is also with that 17-year-old. She's had a lot of difficulty gaining weight. Again, we've been doing a number of medical tests on her in terms of why she's not been able to gain weight for her height. We thought at one point it could be an absorption issue. Literally, her cells and her body were not absorbing the nutrients that she was eating because she was on a meal plan high enough that she should have been gaining weight. And so we thought maybe it's an absorption issue. There's a disease called Addison's disease, where I might get this wrong. She had excessive levels of cortisol in her body, which means she was on overdrive all the time. So she was just burning all the time. So failure to gain weight in proportion to her height, all of these possibilities. Okay. Again, a warning sign. Something's going on. Something's not right. Physical signs are huge. We'll talk about bruised callous knuckles, kind of what that's about. Bloodshot eyes. Again, that could also be substance use, but again, just kind of one of those things to pay attention to. Pale or gray skin. I had a patient come in, 65, I think, 62, 65. She was literally gray. She was literally gray. It was one of the first things I've seen, first times I've seen it, but just so malnourished. And yes, she was very underweight, but she was more gray than she was underweight. So that's just some of the medical complication. Thin peeling nails. Again, I have thin peeling nails, but I'm not malnourished because I have weak nails. So it's all within the context of all the other concerns. Okay, so just kind of keeping it within the context. I have thin peeling nails because I live in Denver and it dries all get out. That's why I have thin peeling nails. disappearing to bathroom after meals. Okay, it's big. Excessive compulsive exercise despite weather. Kind of, you know, those individuals that are out exercising in sweats in the middle of May in Mississippi. It just kind of makes you go, huh? Loss of menstrual cycle. Okay, definitely age specific, but it's huge. Insomnia, inability to sleep. Your brain needs fat in order to sleep and rest. Evidence of vomiting, laxative, enemas, diet pill abuse, that kind of thing. So just good things like, you know, what are parents seeing in the trash? Not you want to encourage your client's parents to go rummaging around the trash, but do they see things that are just out of the ordinary? That sort of thing. Secretive eating, discovery that food is missing. This is huge. Food's gone missing. One of my patients really struggles, current patients really struggles with just stealing her roommate's food. So she has trouble living with someone at college. She just steals her food. And then it just creates all these interpersonal difficulties because they don't get it. And she knows she does it. She doesn't like it, but she just can't help herself. Ritualistic eating. I have to eat at 5:15. I have to do these four things before I eat. There's a lot of, we'll look at kind of what might you see at a mealtime, so to speak, in terms of an eating disorder, but kind of the ritualistic eating of ordering. I eat this, 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 and then I do that pattern, so no, like, spontaneity. I have to purge at this time after I eat. Just any ritual, it's there. So just a lot of that control around the food. Food group avoidance, obsessive focus on calories, carb, fat content. I've gone over that. Skipping meals, denying hunger cues, avoiding eating in front of others. This is big, kind of that social eating, so to speak, in terms of grazing. I know I saw a lot of this in college. Where one individual, I remember thinking about in college and being like, why doesn't she ever sit down to eat? Ding, ding, ding. Then I didn't know what I was saying kind of thing. But just kind of that social eating, kind of always carrying the plate around so no one really knows how much you're eating, or you don't really realize how much you're not eating or how much you are eating. Because if you're sitting down in front of it, there's a little bit more connection with what's going on, a little bit more awareness of what's going on. Withdrawal is huge. Isolation, social withdrawal is huge. One of the big things that we do with our patients is get them reconnected. We'll talk all about reconnection and connection later, but getting them reconnected is huge. So this is just a little list. I'm trying to think of a nice word. A list here in terms of levels of care for patients with eating disorders. outpatient once a week, sometimes twice a week, just depending on how they're doing. Can have outpatient dietitian, outpatient therapist, outpatient psychiatrist. So the outpatient can be kind of as robust as it needs to be. Typically, it's just outpatient therapist. When they're kind of starting to bump up in terms of needed support, you'll see them bring in a dietitian, seeing them bring in a psychiatrist for med management. And then intensive outpatient IOP. I was out at Three Oaks yesterday. I saw some of you at Three Oaks yesterday. And they have IOP there. And so different IOPs range in terms of hours provided, support provided. So I think at Three Oaks, you're going to have to help me.
We're actually
PHP. You are PHP.
Yeah, 20 or more hours a week is what qualifies for PHP.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, so we have an IOP that's only for addiction. So we are any ED behavior that we work with is a PHP.
I am so glad to know that. Oh, okay. You said 20 hours a week is what you are?
Yeah, IOP.
That's cool.
4 hours, 4 to 5 hours.
Interesting. In the state of Colorado, it was 14 for PHP. It's not enough. So I'm glad to hear 20. That's awesome. Okay. So intensive outpatient, for us, that is at ED Care, that's 7 days a week starting out from 10:30 to 3:30, so 6 hours a day. So it's pretty intense IOP. Some IOPs can be, you know, 3 or 4 days a week, 3 hours, and it's just not enough. Again, depends on kind of state by state. So we're 7 days a week from 10:30 to 3:30 for IOP, and then our PHP is 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. I don't work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. I would not be standing here if I was. I'm. The kind of main staff psychologists are there from kind of 9 to 6, really, is kind of what I range. And just during the week, but we provide weekend program. So it really is full time for them. They take full time FMLA, and they are there living. It's really residential, honestly, kind of the 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. And there is a residential level, technically residential. But what we have found, unfortunately, again, going back to insurance, is that insurance is pretty hesitant to cover residential right off the bat. We've had more times than not, unfortunately, the past few weeks, they want to see how they do at PHP, especially knowing that they can live in the Connections House, which is where our patients stay. So they kind of want to see how they do there, which feels such like a setup because it's like, hey, let's see what you do. If you fail, then we'll give you more. So it takes a lot of reframing as to why we want this to happen. Thankfully, the house does allow the patients to do kind of residential level work at the PHP level. And then the inpatient res is kind of... maybe kind of what you see more about on TV or whatnot in terms of hospitalization, lockdown, bathrooms locked, no doors on the bathroom stalls, significant limits around what you can take to treatment. I remember I sent a package to a friend a long time ago who was in treatment, and I couldn't send... fingernail polish. I couldn't sing fingernail polish remover. I had to get really creative in terms of what you send because they'll just use that whether for self-harm or I've had a patient drink hand sanitizer because it has alcohol in it. I mean, it's pretty primitive, if you will. So residential inpatient's very, very serious. And then acute is intensive care unit, very medically unstable. So that is ICU level. So those are kind of different levels. Questions about that? Okay. We spoke a little bit about these, but just some of the risk factors for development of eating disorder. Family history of eating disorder or obesity are huge. So just looking at that genetic component. So any mood disorder illnesses or alcoholism in first-degree relatives. So looking at that piece. Many say that eating disorders are an illness of addiction. A lot of people do, and I definitely get that kind of that mindset. Kind of addicted to the illness, or recently had a patient that was kind of addicted to suffering. It was kind of a term that we had used, where if she stayed sick, she got to avoid life and avoid hardship. And so she was kind of addicted to this idea of all my needs are met by being sick because mom shows up, dad shows up, sister shows up. I get to avoid the death of my sister that happened just 6 months ago. She's 18. Her sister died from an eating disorder. And if she just kind of stays sick, then that's what she organizes around. So kind of this addiction to suffering. So I've had a lot of patients who are not on our substance use track, our addictions track. They're like, but I'm addicted. And I'm like, you know, you kind of have to draw the line somewhere, but I totally get the mindset. These sports, they're just slippery slopes. Again, are they in and of themselves bad? No, but they're difficult. One that's on here is not on here is wrestling. It's huge. Jockeying, is that how you say it? Like riding, jockeys. That's huge. They're just slippery slopes for those that have the family history. Eating disorder, they might have some of these other addictive diseases in the field. So just being aware of it, just kind of something to know as a risk factor. Personality traits are huge. Just yesterday at Three Oaks, there was a question of, do you all treat personality disorders? And I said, yes, we specialize in personality disorders. Just those, long time ago, there was personality disorder of something, inadequacy, just kind of inadequate personality disorder. It was a very long time ago, early DSM. And there's just general personality inadequacies that really make these individuals susceptible. Avoidance is one. We see a lot of histrionic individuals. We see borderline traits daily, hourly, it feels like sometimes. Perfectionism is kind of the quintessential. You know, anorexic presentations, we see a lot of perfectionism. And that perfectionism, I will speak about it later, but it's an endless battle. Looking for the perfectionism, it's an endless battle. With no end and no reward in it. So I try to tell people that, patients that, but they don't believe me. Parents, eating behavior, as well as weight is huge. It's interesting, you know, I'll ask in the first assessment, the first session, you know, what are family meals like? Well, we don't have family meals. How does your mom eat? Well, she goes and exercises all the time. I'm just left to eat by myself, you know, to fend for myself for breakfast. Do you know any eating disorders in your family? No one has eating disorders. And then once we get into treatment, they start describing the characteristics and their eating patterns and like, oh yeah, my mom never has breakfast. What's that about? Or yeah, we never sit down. My mom just kind of fixes all of our food for us, but never sits down and eats with us. It's learned. It's a learned response. It's a learned behavior. So definitely looking at kind of how that might be contributing, to the situation. Physical sexual abuse is huge. About 65% of our patients have a traumatic background, trauma history. It's huge. We have on one of our handouts, there's, we have a trauma track. And so that is, it's a huge piece. Depends on where the patients are in terms of, readiness to process the trauma. Some think they have a trauma background, but they don't know if they do, but they've been told they do. So it all just kind of depends, but definitely physical sexual abuse is going to be huge. Low self-esteem. Kind of need I say more. That's going to play a big part into it. Body image dissatisfaction. And then the history that we definitely talked about. These are just a few more things to look out for if you're seeing someone an outpatient and you're wondering about, do I need a higher level of care? I know yesterday we were kind of consulting about, I don't know any of the specifics, but I just saw a couple of the staff members at Three Oaks be like, oh, yeah, we need to send her off or something. Yeah, we send her to a higher level of care, just some concerns. So, oh, that's the wrong key. I meant to use the red one. Okay. So just kind of looking at some of these red flags. I think loss of progress with less specialized care. We kind of use this as a marker for do they need more? They're regressing or declining in the level of care that they're currently in, whether outpatient, intensive outpatient. So looking at that. Co-occurring is huge. I think I've had one patient in the past like 4 or 5 years that I only gave an eating disorder diagnosis. Everyone else had anxiety, depression, OCD, phobias, substance use, personality disorder. I mean, it's rare just to get flat out eating disorder. I think it's almost 80%, I believe, have anxiety as co-occurring disorder. Meal supervision is required. So they won't complete or they won't keep down what they complete. This might be by report of parent or self-report. I don't want to make it so that they can't speak for themselves. But just as that meal supervision required, that's typically a good sign for them to step up in care. And then medical complications. If there's one takeaway if you have a patient that you think has an eating disorder or says that she has an eating disorder, send them to their primary care physician for an assessment. Do it. And if everything comes back clean, all the merrier. But send them for a full workup. Even better, if you know a PCP that treats eating disorders, you want them to get lab work. You want them, if they're severely underweight or severely overweight, you want them to get an EKG. We'll go over that a little bit more, but if you're considering this, send them for to their PCP for a workup. Okay, it's huge. I don't know why I find this slide fascinating, but I do. When I was just writing it, I think just kind of thinking about all the ways that an eating disorder can show up. And again, you're probably going to see more of this in higher level of care. So I don't want to harp on that too much. But these are some of just the nuances to an eating disorder that we otherwise might not think about. And I think sometimes this is where I get a little, oh, I keep doing that. There we go. Sometimes I notice too much in people's eating habits. And I have to remember that not everybody spends 8 hours a day in the eating disorder world. But these are just some of the things that I still find fascinating. Eating foods in a certain order, we call that ordering. You know, I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to do it clockwise. I'm going to do it counterclockwise. Literally, this is what they think about all the time. Counting the number of chews. Imagine having a meal and just counting in your head how many times you're chewing. It can be too little counting or too much counting. We've had that. Where literally we see people just not swallowing because there's such, or sorry, not chewing, they do swallow. There's such ambivalence about taking in the food that they just swallow it. They don't have to think about what they're eating. And then I think about the joy of eating and it's the joy of food and all the connection that happens around food. And it's very sad. Hiding food in a napkin or clothing. This is huge. This is huge. So we, did I put that on here? I don't think I did. We don't allow people to wear, hoodies or jackets. Just last week, my coworker and I, we're in the hallway right by the dining room. And we just kind of noticed this trail of food up and down the hall. And we were like, what is going on? So we were trying to figure out what it was on the floor. So at one point, we were on all fours on the floor trying to figure out what kind of food it was, whether it was like someone had dropped it from eating their lunch in their office, or if it was a patient that had put it in her pocket and she had left just a little trail. It was the tortillas that they had had for lunch. So we kind of got to deduce who it might have been hiding food. But at one point, we were on the floor, and we just looked at each other, and we were like, what are we doing? This is ridiculous. But we're detectives, so we're trying to do that. So hiding food in napkin is huge. Eating excessively fast or too slowly. We currently have a patient right now who will wait until 10 minutes prior to the end of the meal and eat her entire meal in about 5 to 10 minutes because she cannot handle having a whole meal for 40 minutes. Wearing heavy clothing to disguise body, that's huge, very, very common. So big baggy clothes because just want to appear larger than they are, kind of try to manipulate the system. Excessively talking about food, kind of a rule of no food talk. No, like, your meal plan's bigger than mine, or, oh, you don't have this, or you don't have that. We just kind of say, let's not go there. This is huge. Consuming condiments such as salt or sugar. There we go. So there's salt or sugar to excess on menu items. We limit patients' salt packets to 2 per meal. And there's kind of several theories behind this. One is that if you put excessive salt on your food, you can't taste it. And they have trouble tasting it. They don't want to taste it because then they're faced with, oh, this tastes good, but can it taste good? Because I don't know if I want it to taste good, because if I want it to taste good, then I'll eat it. I mean, talk about dissonance all the time. So they'll just put tons and tons of salt or sugar in the same way. Another piece, too, is that the starved brain, it needs that much salt and sugar to taste anything. So it kind of depends on what angle they're coming from. But many times, the sense of taste is just a luxury. So the brain's going to zap that out of there when your body is in full starvation mode. So in order for them to even be able to be willing to have part of the meal, they'll put excessive salt, excessive sugar, or excessive heat. My patients that will heat their food, so we have to limit how much they heat their food. Ketchup is one that they'll do hot sauce or ketchup or something like that. ketchup is kind of, that could be part of the taste piece, but it also is just kind of ketchup is kind of a condiment that we see a lot of patients just using kind of in a disordered way in terms of like ketchup with peanut butter. I don't know why. I don't know why. I really don't. So we kind of have to say, like, no, ketchup's not allowed at this meal. And so it's kind of hard. It's case by case as to why. There's some weird combinations out there, y'all. So it's kind of hard to know case by case why they're using the ketchup. So we typically just ask, you know, why are you wanting this kind of thing? Apparently carrots and peanut butter is a normal thing. We had a big debate as a staff. I know. We had a big debate as to whether or not we wanted to harp on this or not. And somebody raised their hand and said, no, I do carrots with peanut butter all the time. And I was like, okay. So it's things like that we kind of have to be careful about. Yeah.
I'm just wondering how much of, I can just see the, maybe the divide in the patients and you guys and me having to work against that constantly.
Absolutely. It's a great thing. Great question. I think I definitely feel what you're alluding to, and that I don't want to be food police. And a lot of times I am. I actually am not on the front lines as much with the patients. Our meal youth therapists are. They're the ones that are literally having the meals with them. And so they have a very, very difficult role. They are on the front lines. I get to sit and do the rewarding work with them, you know, after they've you know, been the food police and been the rule enforcer. And we have open conversations about it all the time of why are you coming down so hard on me about this, or why are you questioning this? And it's just it's a place of, because we know how manipulative eating disorders are, and it is hard to trust the process. We talk about trusting the process all the time, the process of treatment, it being for them, even though it feels like it is solely against them, and that is because they are like this with the eating disorder. And so anytime that we're trying to do this, there's just that resistance, and so that's when we become the police. And so it's just open conversation all the time, if not weekly, daily. Yeah, just naming the dynamic because it's there. And I feel it. I think that's what burns me out pretty quickly, is just is having to call attention to everything all the time. And that's my job. That's what I got to do, you know. But yeah, you're picking up on it, definitely. Not touching lips to silverware. That's something, I don't see it that much, but definitely it's there. Drinking all the fluids before eating any of the foods because you fill up. You all know if you have a Coke before your meal comes, you're not hungry when the meal comes. you fill up on the drinks. Not allowing food to touch one another is huge. Using a knife and fork to eat a sandwich. It's definitely happened. Just minimize is kind of their thought. What is the least avoidant way I can consume this meal? And that is eating a sandwich with a knife and a fork. Cutting food into small pieces, tiny pieces. Stealing food. I had a case, this one is, she was kind of an anomaly to me in a lot of ways, but we had this pantry where we kept all of our dried goods, the trail mixes and the chips and just where we kept all of our dried goods. In my office, I had a direct view of that closet, which is dangerous because I've been accused of taking food from work, but not in a disordered way, but just when I want a snack. But I had a direct view, and I would sit there, and she would just round the corner, and she would go in that closet all the time. And one time, our chef, it was his temporary office, and he walked in, and she was on all fours underneath his desk and had the big bags of candy from Costco, like the 10-pound whatever, and just she was in one of those disoriented, detached states. He's not a clinician, so he just had this moment of like, what am I supposed to do? Because we talked about it as a team, and at first you kind of laugh because it's so shocking. It's kind of just that, like, I don't know. You don't really know what to do, so you just kind of laugh, and then it sets in of how sad it is that she was just in that state. So I always think about her when I see that bullet point. And then this one is new. This wiping remnants of food out of the mouth, this is new. We've got a patient that's just doing this recently, so I added that. So after a meal, she'll just clean out her mouth. It's very, very primitive. It's very regressed. It's very sick. They're very, very ill. So just kind of those things that they might look for at a meal. So major changes, kind of go through this quickly. The DSM-5, although I lamented having a new DSM because I had to take the ECCC, which is the board exam for psychologists, I had to learn the new DSM to take the ECCC. It was awful, but made it through because it came out right at the same time. So at first I lamented it, but in terms of the eating disorder categories, very, very thankful for the DSM-5 because it's much more inclusive than the DSM-4. Thanks to research, thanks to awareness, advocacy, much, much more inclusive. Primarily, binge eating disorder. Previously, this was under, it was in the Appendix C, back in the back of the DSM-4, other categories to be studied or other categories for further study was binge eating disorder in the DSM-4. So this is huge that we now have kind of full leverage to use this as a diagnosis. With anorexia nervosa, AN, the word refusal was removed from the list of qualifications or criteria because it really just was too specific. It really narrowed, it was too narrow. And again, insurance would kind of harp on that. Well, they're not refusing, therefore they don't have it. So just kind of wanted to make it more broad. Another thing is the requirement of amenorrhea or absence of 3+ menstrual cycles was removed because eating disorders span such a large age range that you have postmenopausal women coming in. Well, they're not going to have their cycle. You have 21-year-olds who are on birth control. They're not going to have their cycle. You have those that, for other reasons, have irregular menstrual cycles. And we don't want to use that as a rule out. So thankfully, that was removed. That's really given a lot of freedom. Addition of pica, so the eating of unedible items, rocks, dirt, paper, pica was added. Rumination disorder was added. Chewing, swallowing, and then regurgitation and swallowing, again, was rumination disorder. That was added. And then ARFID. ARFID is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. This is picky eating on steroids. Okay? Picky eater, again, non-clinical, non-disordered. You're just a picky eater. You have preferences. This is a 26-year-old who ate 5 foods, came in. Chicken nuggets, McDonald's and Tyson chicken nuggets only, though. McDonald's hamburger. What else would he eat? I mean, literally 5 foods. By the time he left treatment, he was eating 20 foods. So a lot of exposure therapy. I remember my coworker, she said, we had cheese today. I mean, they sat in their office and had a bite of cheese. He didn't know he liked cheese. Now he loves cheese. So again, how does that happen? All the different pieces, genetics, life events, kind of all those things kind of play into it. So that's picky eating on steroids. And then this whole other section that we went over, OSFED, the purging disorder, atypical anorexia, bulimia and BED, low frequency or duration, and then the nighttime eating syndrome. And then there is that other section that is reserved for if the, you know, the individual, the therapist is not yet ready or able to make a diagnosis. There is that unspecified that are in most categories in the DSM. But it's pretty rare that we use that. Insurance really doesn't like that one. It is there. But really, we use the OSFED a good bit more, so that's been very helpful. With this one, it just speaks to the comorbidity piece. Again, we're looking at predisposing factors, complications, and then common cause. Reason I put this up here is it's a little bit of the chicken or the egg sometimes. I'll give you an example. She's 19. She's another one that discharged when I left. She had, I'm going to mispronounce it, enematophobia, the fear of vomiting. That was her primary phobia. So she had a lot of anxiety, but she had fear of vomiting. But because she was so scared of vomiting, she wouldn't eat, which means that she restricted. And then she had more anxiety around food. She also had IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. But her anxiety contributed to IBS. But, you know, did she have IBS because she restricted her food? I mean, just this constant. So what's predisposing, what's complicating the situation? Is it the chicken or the egg? Is it anxiety first? Is it the eating disorder first? And so we did put primary. Actually, I think she's one that I put unspecified. because we really didn't know. But she then had the phobia diagnosis. She had IBS. So she was one that we actually kind of left rule out because we didn't know which one was first, which one was primary. But this just speaks to the psychopathology of that anxiety increases risk of eating disorder, but then also the anxiety as a result of the eating disorder. So it really is kind of that continuous loop. All right. We will take a break. We'll come back 9:45-ish, but take a break. Feel free to hang around, ask questions.